He had been clear over in his room, praying before sleep, but even with the window just cracked, he had recognized Joaquin's voice. He had excellent hearing because of his two large coyote ears. "That's our Joaquin." Tony raised an eyebrow.
"Isn't he that kid in that shirt that barks?"
"Indeed, indeed," Padre Jimenez said. "How I've watched that boy grow over the last few years. I would recognize his voice anywhere. But he didn't say that he was Joaquin on the radio, did he? What is he calling himself?"
"Diablo, Diablo."
Tony mimicked the way Joaquin said it, accidentally throwing in a bit of his Tony Triumph voice. It sounded impressive. Jenny's smile was full of delight. "Oh dear," Padre Jimenez said. "I do wish that young people would realize there are better ways to appear edgy than invoking the great destroyer of men. Perhaps the station named him."
"No dice, Father Lassie," Tony said. "That's a pirate station."
Padre Jimenez craned his neck back to peer at Tony. "I don't follow."
"It's an illegal station. He named himself."
"How do you know it's illegal?"
"No legit station has a kid DJ spinning Del Shannon at 11 p.m., Tony said. Even from his great height, he saw Padre Jimenez's ears flag. "Don't get your pants twisted. He's getting his legs under him. It'll be good for him, as long as he doesn't get caught. I wonder if he built his gear himself."
"Joaquin?" Padre Jimenez said. "More likely Beatriz." "Yes, Beatriz is much more likely to have built something." Tony remembered Beatriz Soria felling Pete Wyatt at his feet just the day before. She'd been carrying a skirtful of wire, an odd nest that had puzzled him at the time, but made sense now. Tony was provoked to interest despite himself.
"Is Beatriz into the radio?"
Padre Jimenez cocked his head. No one knew what Beatriz Soria was into. She is a strange young woman.
"Don't get twisted, Padre," Tony said. "But coming from you, that's pretty rich."
The sound of conversation attracted Robbie and Betsy, the twins. They had been quarreling in their room out of boredom, and when they heard voices outside, they went to the window. When they saw a group gathered around a radio, they incorrectly assumed that it was a party. Some arguments are better than a party, but not theirs, and so they bundled up in sweaters and joined the others by Tony.
"Keep that snake away from me," Tony said, "or I'll step on all three of you."
As Diablo Diablo's voice came back onto the radio, the sound attracted Marisita's attention. She had just returned from yet another unsuccessful search for Daniel, and she was weary and disheartened. Because she had been out all day, she didn't know about the message Daniel had left for her, and she feared that he might be dead or too far away for her to ever find. Now she paused just inside the doctor's cabin, the door cracked. From there she could hear the rise and fall of Joaquin's voice. It was too far away to make out what he was saying clearly, but she recognized the cadence from her time on the show. She could also see the other pilgrims from where she stood. Tony, looming, just his feet and knees in her sight, both barely lit by the porch lights. Jenny, sitting cross-legged by the radio. The twins and Padre, busily constructing a fire pit against the cool night. Marisita imagined herself going to where they were all gathered, with delicacies in tow. In her head, she asked them,
"Room for one more? I've made a few things for us to eat."
But in reality, she remained where she was, water dripping over her hands onto the floor. She would have liked to attribute her hesitation to exhaustion, but she knew that it was more than that. If she thought about it, she could admit that if it had been a gathering of Sorias rather than pilgrims, she would have been inexorably attracted, and, if not for the taboo, would have approached them at once. Marisita studied herself hard, trying to determine if it was judgment on her part.
Was she biased against the pilgrims for being stuck halfway as she was?
No, it was not that at all. What would be different about speaking to a Soria than a pilgrim? And then she hit upon it. It was the way the pilgrims spoke to one another. They were all aware that this was a temporary situation, and so they were cordial acquaintances, at best. Conversation skipped along the surface. She imagined the Soria's gatherings were less chit-chat and more real, the kind of intimacy that comes from knowing people for a long time, and knowing you would know them for a long time in the future, too. Then she realized that it was really that she just missed being part of a family. It is entirely possible to have this kind of conversation with slight acquaintances, too, but none of this current crop of pilgrims had yet realized that. Marisita would have left the pilgrims to their chit-chat and gone to bed for some fitful and guilty sleep if she had not just then recognized that what Jenny had brought to munch on was a bag of corn snacks. Marisita did not ordinarily require other people's things to be perfect, only herself. But corn snacks were so far from perfect that Marisita felt her own overall perfection draining. She forgot her exhaustion and her guilt. Corn snacks. She began to prepare food beneath her umbrellas, furiously, quickly, wanting to be able to deliver it before the radio show was over, before the others decided to go to bed. She heated up her skillet, and while she waited for that to be hot, she cut fat slices of watermelon and cucumbers and orange, and squeezed lime on them, wiping the sprays of lime out of the corners of her eyes, and then she dashed chili powder and salt over them all. By then the skillet was hot enough for her to place as many fresh cobs of corn as she could fit into it. While the corn roasted, she cubed a fresh pineapple and added mint and sugar and more lime juice in the gaping mouth of the blender. While the blender ran in the background, she stirred together crema and guajillo chili pepper and mayonnaise and crumbled cotija cheese to make a thin sauce. She tore cilantro into fresh scented shreds and added it to the bowl. Then, still waiting for the corn, she rapidly began to make colorful banderillas for those who didn't have a sweet tooth, spearing lip-puckering pickled gherkins, salty olives, and bright pickled red peppers. And finally, the corn was roasted and she transferred it to a platter and poured the crema and cheese over it. It had been only 10 minutes since she had decided to prepare refreshments, and now she had some fruit with chile and some savory banderillas and some elotes and some eye-opening agua fresca to wash it all down with. It was not perfect, but it was closer than anyone else in Bicho Raro could come to it. She piled it all up under umbrellas in her arms and walked briskly to where the others sat. Padre Jimenez hurried over to relieve some of the platters from her arms. He licked his lips. "You're a miracle, Marisita Lopez." Now the twins' previous assumption was correct. It was a party. Even Theldon took part. He didn't come out of the house very far, but he at least put his chair outside the door instead of inside it. They ate Marisita's food and sang along to the songs, and the twins danced a little, as well as they could with the snake tangled around them. Tony veered dangerously close to Tony Triumph as he told the stories behind the music Joaquin played, but the truth was that Tony had always loved to tell people the story of music. Padre Jimenez was the one who realized Marisita had probably not heard of the message Daniel had left for her. He gestured her close, which was a mostly unselfish impulse on his part, and told her of it as her miraculous rain sprinkled across his forehead. "Marisita, I'm listening," he repeated. "Did you know?" Marisita's ears rang with shock, but her voice was quite calm. "No, Padre, I didn't."
"I didn't think so," he said with satisfaction. "Your elotes are perfection, by the way.
Nearly,
she whispered, but only in her head. Out loud, she said,
Thank you.
She sat with a pretty smile on her face, but inside, she was thinking about that message, and she was thinking about how Joaquin and Beatriz had asked her to be on the show again. Although none of the songs Joaquin played were particularly punitive, she nonetheless felt as if with every minute Joaquin spent trying to comfort his cousin, she was being reminded of how she was doing nothing. Yes, she was looking for Daniel, but that was what she wanted from her. What he wanted was for her to tell her story on air. She couldn't do it. He didn't realize that everyone would despise her. As the pilgrims warmed to one another, somehow united by Tony's irascible presence, she felt ever cooler. If they knew her real past, they would never call her a miracle. In a pause in the programming, Jenny blurted out,
As I walk along, I wonder what went wrong.
All eyes landed on her. No one knew at first why the moment felt unusual. But slowly, they began to suspect that it was because no one had prompted Jenny with any words. She just said it. The pilgrims looked from one to another, replaying the conversation, trying to remember if any of the others had said that phrase. Finally, Betsy asked,
Did you say that on your own?
Did you say that on your own?
Jenny echoed, but she nodded furiously. After a long night of watching the other pilgrims being closer than they had ever been before, Jenny had wanted desperately to prompt Tony to talk about what had brought him here to Bicho Raro, and how such a funny and loud person found himself stranded as a giant in the wilderness. Jenny had tried to string these words together from scratch, failing, as always, and then finally, she had burst out with the rhyming couplet. How did you say that on your own? Padre asked.
How did you say that on your own? Jenny asked.
She looked helplessly to Tony, certain that he, of everyone here, would understand what had happened. Earlier in the evening, he would have merely responded to this appeal of hers with a snappy comeback of some kind. But now, he looked at her hopeful expression, made haunting by the porch lights, and he genuinely wanted her to have accomplished something that night. Tony said,
Can you say it again, doll?
As I walk along, I wonder what went wrong, Jenny said.
This exchange astounded all of them. Not only had she not repeated what he'd said, but she had once again said something entirely different. Things were changing. God moves, Padre Jimenez cried, but Tony waved an impatient hand in his direction.
Lyrics, Tony said. It's lyrics from Runaway.
Someone else's words, Marisita remarked. But not when they say them. Can you do another one? Can you do another one?
Jenny echoed. But then she struggled for a long moment, frowning, trying to think, trying to conjure words where there had not been any just a moment before. Then she said,
No matter how I try, I just can't turn the other way.
Connie Francis, Tony said, my heart has a mind of its own.
Well done, Jenny, well done. This is progress, Padre Jimenez said, clasping her hands in his. She repeated his words, but gladly.
I reckon you could say almost anything you need to say with lyrics, Betsy said.
I don't know about that, Robbie said.
It's progress, Padre Jimenez said again.
For a minute, no one spoke. There was no music either, because the radio programming had come to an end. But nonetheless, the air was noisy with optimism and cheer, every pilgrim buoyed by just one pilgrim's success. Then, an owl hooted sleepily, woken briefly by the distant promise of Jenny's second miracle, and they all remembered how late it was. Jenny peered up at Tony, and he realized he was, somehow, being consulted for wisdom. He said simply,
"You're gonna need to listen to the radio a lot more."
Chapter 20. When Beatrice, Pete, and Joaquin arrived back at Bicho Raro, everything was quiet and dark, except for the soft noises of owls that had begun to gather again. All of the pilgrims and the bonfire had burned out and quieted. Joaquin crept away to sneak back into the camper, a process that was possible only if he moved very slowly. It took an hour for him to accomplish it from beginning to end. This left Beatrice and Pete standing in the cold night, gazing at Bicho Raro. It is surprising how a strange place can change with just a little familiarity. When Pete had arrived in Bicho Raro, not very long ago, the chilly night had felt full of eerie and unfriendly entities. The structures had seemed less like houses than outcroppings, none of it welcoming. But now, it merely appeared to be a sleepy collection of homes, a friendly port in the vast dry sea of night. The whispers he heard were merely the owls on the rooflines. The shivers over his skin were merely from being so close to the desert and to Beatrice. He knew the bed waiting for him was only the floor beside Padre Jimenez's bed, but he didn't mind it. It is surprising, too, how a familiar place can change with just a little strangeness. Beatrice had lived in Bicho Raro for her entire life, and she could have navigated it in full dark. She knew all of the sounds and smells and shapes in it, and she knew how this invisible dark felt when it curled between the buildings to sleep. She knew that many people were frightened by Bicho Raro after dark. But night here had always been a comfortable time for her, a time when her thoughts could stretch into the quiet without anyone else's voice intruding. But tonight her home seemed strange and awake, every board and every nail and every shingle sharply visible in the dim lights, all of it marvelously distinct, like she had never seen it before. It was as if she was afraid. Her head wasn't frightened. Her thoughts proceeded quite as usual. But her heart felt as if it was racing. But she did not think she minded it. Pete said,
"I'm nearly finished with the stage."
"I saw," Beatrice replied.
"Do you think you would like to test it with me?" Pete asked.
He held out his hand, and Beatrice thought for a moment before taking it. Together they climbed onto the amber-brown dance stage and walked across the boards into the very center. They stopped and faced each other.
"I don't know how to dance," Beatrice admitted.
"I don't either," Pete said. "I guess we'll figure it out."
Beatrice took his free hand and put it on her waist.
"It's cold,"
Beatrice said.
"It is," Pete said.
He stood a little closer to her so that they were warm together.
"There's no music," Beatrice said.
"We need the radio."
But the station had long since gone quiet, and Diablo Diablo had long since turned back into Joaquin. Pete put his voice right by Beatrice's ear so that his breath warmed her skin, and he began to sing. It was nothing extravagant, just Patsy Cline sung in his low and uneven voice, and they began to dance. It was very quiet. No one else would have seen if not for the desert. But when the desert heard Pete Wyatt singing a love song, it took notice. The desert loved him, after all, and wanted him happy. So when it heard Pete singing, it rose a wind around them until the breeze sang gently like strings, and when it heard Pete singing, it provoked the air to heat and cool around every stone and plant, so that each of these things sounded in harmony with his voice,
and when it heard Pete singing, it roused Colorado's grasshoppers to action, and they rubbed their legs together like a soft horn section. And when it heard Pete singing, it shifted the very ground beneath Bicho Raro, so that the sand and the dirt pounded a beat that matched the sound of the incomplete heart that lived in Pete Wyatt. The sound of this roused the Sorias from their sleep. Francisco looked out of his greenhouse and saw Pete and Beatriz dancing, and he missed Antonia. Antonia looked out the window of her house and saw Pete and Beatriz dancing, and she missed Francisco. Luis, the one-handed, took out his future love's box of gloves from beside his bed and counted them. Nana reached for the photograph of her long-dead husband. Michael had been sleeping rolled up in his own lengthy beard, but he woke up and returned to sleep rolled up with Rosa instead. Judith looked out her window and wept with happiness to see her sister happy, and Eduardo wept too, because he always liked to dress to match his wife when he could. As she danced with Pete, Beatriz was thinking that, perhaps, this was what performing the miracle felt like for Daniel. The sensation inside her felt like it came both from inside her and from some place very much outside her, which was impossible and illogical and miraculous. If Daniel had been there, he would have told her that this was because holiness was love, but he was not, so she had to merely wonder if she finally understood her family a little better. Pete was thinking that he liked Beatrice's quiet, watchful ways, and he was thinking that he liked the way that she felt, and he was thinking that he could feel his heart, but not in a bad way. He realized that he had been wrong to think that joining the army or starting a moving company would satisfy that hole in his heart. He had thought he had lived a happy life, but now he understood that he had only ever been content. This moment was his first moment of true happiness, and now he had to readjust every other expectation in his life to match it. They both felt more solid than they had before, although neither had realized they had not felt solid enough before. When they stopped dancing, Pete sweetly kissed Beatrice's cheek. Beatrice took Pete's hand and held his arm still. Then she put her thumb right on the inside of his elbow. It was just as warm and soft as she had thought it would be when she first saw it. Her thumb fit perfectly.
"How about," Pete started, "how about I don't take the truck until all this business with Danielle's darkness is over with?"
Beatriz considered. There were many ways that Danielle's darkness could end, some faster than others. If they didn't need to drive out into the desert to reach Danielle, they didn't need the truck. She could find another way to make Joaquin a radio that could be hidden in a hurry. It was very fair. Too fair. Because
that could be a long time.
I know.
She put a hand on his gentle cheek.
I think you did a good job on this stage.
Thank you, he replied.
Chapter 21. You can hear a miracle a long way after dark, even when you are dying. Daniel Lupe Soria curled in the blackness and listened to the slow but urgent movement of a far-off miracle slowly drawing closer. It was miles off, days off maybe, but it was so quiet out here that there was nothing to interfere with his listening. He was so thoroughly a saint that all of his body still responded to the call. His lips were already forming a prayer for whoever this pilgrim might be. He was halfway through a prayer to make himself more pure of mind and body before he remembered that he would not be performing this miracle. Daniel would not be anywhere near Bicho Raro when this pilgrim arrived. He didn't know what the pilgrim would find when she or he reached Bicho Raro.
He didn't know if Beatrice would perform the miracle despite her misgivings, or if Michael might return to the position of saint after nearly a decade away from it. He didn't even know if it was still night. His eyes were closed, but it didn't matter. It would look the same if he opened them. Everything was darkness. It had been nothing but darkness for many hours. After he had left the message for Marisita, he had begun to put distance between himself and the words, in case she or his cousins were tempted to find him. All the while, his vision had been narrowing, those black curtains closing on either side. He could not help blinking again and again, as if he would clear his eyes. But the darkness came on relentlessly. The creature that he had sensed before was still following him, too, although Daniel had not caught a glimpse of it. Now he could not shake the idea that the creature itself was taking his vision. A few hours after Daniel left the message behind, his fortune had run out. By that time, his vision was gray and greedy, and so was his mouth. His limbs were heavy. When he found a barbed wire fence blocking his forward progress, he wasted uncountable minutes walking alongside it, hoping for a gate to pass through. But this was wild country, and there was no need of gates, so the only way was through. This would not have been such an ordeal if he had been able to see, but with only starved light coming from the fast-setting sun, and with only starved light coming to him through his eyes, it felt to him as if every inch of the wire was thorned. The spacing between the strands refused to make sense. His pack with its water and food in it snagged on one of the thorns as he tried to tug through, and when he retreated to ease the tension on it, the bag fell from his shoulders. It seemed impossible for it to have gone far, but his hands could not find it in the murk. His blind spider eyes brushed up against only grass, and more wire, and posts, and then again grass, and more wire, and posts. Knowing that he could be within inches of it without finding it made his search even more agonizing than it might have been. It was gone. Daniel did not have enough sight left to find a new source of water, so he instead felt his way to a large bush. He moved beneath it as slowly as he could to be sure he was not displacing an unseen snake, and then he curled there. It was not much, but it would be some shelter from the sun when it came out next. It would at least keep him from dehydrating as quickly, and after he died, it would take longer for the birds and foxes to find him. Now that he was no longer trying to move, he had enough energy left to be surprised that this was how the darkness would kill him. It seemed mundane and inappropriate for a saint to die from lack of water rather than from an epic battle for his soul. Daniel had expected that the Soria darkness would be virulent and hellish, not ordinary and wasting. As he lay in the dry scrub, he began to doubt that he had been a good saint after all. Perhaps, he thought, he had been doing a disservice to the pilgrims. Perhaps another Soria could have freed them from their darkness faster, or better. Perhaps he had been just a man playing at God. "Forgive me," he prayed, and his heart felt a little lighter. As the stars had come out that night, he had turned on the radio, waiting, hoping, for Marisita's voice to come out. "Forgive yourself," he told the air. But Marisita had not forgiven herself, and so she had not come onto the radio to tell her story. He'd had to settle for Diablo Diablo, which was still a comfort. He laughed and winced as Joaquin read one of Daniel's old journal entries about his time as a hellraiser, and he sang and sighed as Joaquin played some of his favorite songs. Around the time that Jenny was realizing she could speak using lyrics,
Daniel had cast his eyes up to the sky and realized the stars had vanished for him. The radio fell into dull static as Joaquin and Beatriz stopped transmitting. The creature clucked. Daniel was now entirely in darkness. He curled more tightly around himself and hooked his finger into the divot in his skin where the hailstone had marked him a sinner. When things are dark, we cannot stop our minds from running wild, and so it was with Daniel. He could not prevent his thoughts from galloping to a future where Joaquin was the one to find his body. And then his mind advanced even further to when Antonia and Francisco and Rosa and Michael would be forced to see another Soria who had fallen prey to his own darkness. Daniel was no fool. He knew he was loved, and he knew how love can become a blunt and relentless weapon at death. They didn't deserve this pain a generation later. And Marisita, hadn't she suffered enough? She was already doubled up with guilt, and she would easily take the blame for his death, even though it was all on Daniel. And of course, Beatriz. She would be made the saint. He knew it was true. Michael would never be persuaded to take on that role again. She would do it, and she would not complain. But it would be a prison for her. The idea of his family's suffering tormented him, drowning out the dryness in his mouth and the blackness in front of his eyes. Instead of praying for himself, his cracked lips formed words for them instead. Mother? But it was not a mother who answered. Pebbles skittered against pebbles, and the smell of crushed sage came to Daniel. Something large was moving toward him. He heard the cluck of that creature again, and then a flap. He guessed correctly that whatever it was had wings. It was flapping farther from him, driven away by whatever approached, but not too far away. He heard breathing, creaking. Daniel sat up then, but he was too dizzy to defend himself, even if he had been able to see. Something clasped his throat. Rough hair strayed across his cheek. Breath panted across his face. Daniel imagined a horse-haired monster, a devil's plaything finally come to finish him. Another hand clasped over his jaw. Daniel gasped. Water poured over his lips and into his ears. He was so shocked that he coughed on it at first. It trickled over his cracked lips and down his throat and onto his chest, and it felt so good to be wet after being so dry that he could not believe he was not dreaming it. Except no dream can feel as good as a drink of water when you're dying of thirst. His relief melted, though, as he revived enough to worry that he had been found by a Soria. "Who are you?" he asked. Damp fingers pressed his useless eyes and smeared water and grease on his chapped lips and poured more water into his mouth. Three different voices muttered in three different languages. He could have never guessed who had come in answer to his prayer, and he may not have been able to guess it even if he had been able to see, because it was a form of miracle of the kind that even a Soria did not normally experience. The spirits of the wild men of Colorado, Felipe Soria, who had killed the sheriff for his femurs, Beatrice's financier, who had hung himself with his own beard, and the German, who was a fox as of the time of his death, had come to him. Who knew why they came to him then, and not before or after? Perhaps they were atoning for the sins of their lives. Perhaps Daniel's prayer was fervent enough to call them from wherever spirits lingered. Perhaps they were just passing through on their way to another traveler in distress and stopped to aid Daniel along the way. For whatever reason, they let him drink until he was full. The financier found Daniel's canteen, and the German filled it, and Felipe Soria put it in blind Daniel's hand.
Zwei Tage Wasser,
the German said.
2 days of water,
translated the financier, who had once spent a year in Frankfurt chasing success.
Felipe Soria leaned close.
Fight my cousin,
he whispered in Daniel's ear.
¿Quién quiere celeste? ¿Qué le cueste?
No one had to translate this for Daniel. He who wants heaven must pay. He pressed his thumb into Daniel's other shoulder, and Daniel cried out. When Felipe removed his hand, he had left a divot that matched the one the hailstorm had left him with. Then, they were gone, and Daniel was left alone. In the dark, but alive. For now.
Chapter 22. Pete worked.
He got up at first light, because Padre Jimenez yipped and paddled his legs in his sleep, and because the floor beside Padre Jimenez's bed was hard and cold, and also because Pete's mind kept returning to Beatriz, and also because Pete was good at working and liked doing it. As no one else was around to direct him otherwise, Pete decided to simply continue work on the stage. He had barely stepped out into the cold, thin air, however, when Antonia appeared before him. She had not been sleeping either. After seeing her daughter and Pete dancing on the stage the night before, she had stayed awake all night long, feverishly cutting paper flowers to occupy her mind. When the sun rose, she looked down and realized that she had constructed piles of black paper roses, all but one of them marred by tears. She had stormed out to meet Pete the moment she saw him get up. Now she stood before him in the early blue light and raged at him for several minutes while he mutely accepted it. Finally, as the sun began to cast long morning shadows behind the buildings, she spat on the ground and gave him his task. Finish the small house that he had begun to construct the first day he had arrived.
Padre Jimenez can live there when you're done, she said, and then you can have his room.
Pete was bruised by her raging, but he recognized this small kindness and was surprised by it. Tentatively, he admitted,
I thought you were angry at me.
Angry? At you?
For dancing with Beatriz.
It had not even occurred to Antonia that he might take ownership of her undirected anger. Her surprise over this passed swiftly away from shock, took an inexplicable side trip through grief over Daniel, and finally arrived at yet more anger. She snapped,
I'm not angry at you or Beatriz.
Ma'am? Do you mind me asking who you're angry at, then?
As Antonia Soria opened her mouth, dozens of names filled the space behind her teeth, waiting to be said. But in that moment, as she saw Pete's guileless face and, behind him, the outline of Francisco's greenhouse, and in it, its sleepless occupant looking back at her, she realized that the only name that was true in that space was her own.
Just get back to work, Wyatt, Antonia said. I'm going back to sleep.
But Pete did not just get to work. He meant to, but as he crossed the early morning quiet of Bicho Raro, his attention was snagged by the sight of Tony rummaging in the back of the box truck. He changed course immediately. Tony had gotten up even earlier than Pete and Antonia. The moment it was light enough to see, the very first thing he had done was seek out the source of the radio program he had heard the night before. He had several clues. For starters, he knew it had to be someplace that Joaquin Soria, a 16-year-old boy, was capable of reaching each night. He knew it had to have some kind of antenna apparatus, and that an antenna of the size required for such a sound would be difficult to hide in a small space. And most importantly, he had been dozing only lightly the night before when Joaquin and Beatriz and Pete came back, and so he had seen them climb out of the truck. There were some advantages to being a giant. When Pete found him, Tony had the back of the truck wide open and was in it up to his shoulders. He was thrilling over what he found inside. All of the things that frustrated Beatrice about the makeshift station, the ingenious workarounds, the repurposed equipment, delighted Tony. As a radio personality, he didn't touch anything like this. The station he worked at was vast and polished, with two friendly Serbians to make sure it was all performing well as he did his show. It had been a very long time since he had been near the guts and organs of radio. Now, he reached his oversized arm in the truck and gently prized out components to examine. "Did your mother raise you to be a sneak and a thief?" Pete asked. Tony removed his arm from the truck and turned to Pete.
"Did your mother raise you to be a Boy Scout?"
"Yes," said Pete.
"Look, kid, untwist yourself. I'm not hurting anything."
"You're absolutely lousy when you lose your sense of humor. I was just looking."
"Why?"
Tony turned back to the truck.
"Why not?"
Pete was ready to launch into an explanation of how the truck belonged to someone else and it was considered rude to rummage through other people's property, but before he even said it, he realized that Tony already knew these things quite well.
"I need you to give my box of records to that kid, if they haven't melted to pancake batter," Tony said.
His voice was muffled inside the truck.
"Diablo, Diablo. They're new. New stuff. Tell him he better listen to them all, because he needs some fresher music."
"Shh. I think his identity's a secret."
"Kid, nothing's a secret when you broadcast it on AM radio. Tell him I want to help him."
"Are you sure?" Pete asked. "That sounds suspiciously like a nice thing to do, which doesn't sound like you."
"Look, there's your funny bone. I thought you'd lost it. Tell him I want to see his script for tonight. Tell him who I am."
"I thought that was a secret. Like Diablo Diablo." Tony pulled his head out of the truck to face Pete with all of his height. Pete could not know it, because he had never known him before he had gotten burned out at the radio station, but Tony currently looked more like his normal self than he had in years, even at 20 feet tall. The life had returned to his eyes.
"Are you going to do it or not?"
Of course Pete was going to do it. He agreed under the condition that Tony cease and desist his trespassing, and then he returned to work. By then, the rest of Bicho Raro had woken. Everyone, pilgrims and Sorias alike, heard Jenny enthusiastically practicing her new skill. As the radio blared from her bedroom, she spoke loudly and independently in fragments of lyrics heard minutes before.
"Oh, what a beautiful morning," she greeted Padre Jimenez. "Life is sweet. It may sound silly, but I don't care," she told Robbie. "I'm going to fix this world today," she told Pete as she marched past the little house.
"I'm glad to hear it," Pete replied, as she merely grinned instead of repeating what he said.
Her enthusiasm was catching, and no one caught it harder than Joaquin. By midday, both he and Beatrice had found their way to Pete's worksite and kept him company in their own way. Beatrice sat silently out of the way, constructing a dipole cage antenna, admiring how Pete had stripped off his T-shirt as the work grew harder. Joaquin paced on top of a beam, prattling endlessly with increasingly grandiose ideas. He was in bright spirits. For the first time in his young life, he felt he was doing what he was truly meant to do. He was proud of last night's broadcast, and hoped that Daniel really had been able to hear it. He was also more than willing to take credit for Jenny's improvement. He was full of pride, too, that his audience had widened to include the pilgrims.
"Our broadcast could heal them all," he said.
This was such a boastful statement that Beatrice finally broke her silence.
"It may have been coincidence. She may have been just about to make a breakthrough anyway."
When Joaquin pouted, she added,
I'm not saying the radio wasn't part of it. I'm merely saying it requires another trial.
What kind of trial would satisfy you?
Something very specifically directed with the intent of helping, so we could measure the results and know it was from us.
I don't know what that means.
Beatriz put down her antenna.
For instance, if you prepared a program specifically for the twins, highlighting what they needed to heal themselves, then, if they improved quickly, that would be a result.
Joaquin shivered where he sat, both with the thrill of having such a direct effect and with the residual fear of breaking a long-held taboo in such a dramatic way.
But with the purpose of it hidden, he said, no names mentioned, so no one would realize it was someone from Pichoraro.
Pete spoke from inside the half-finished house.
Also, if you don't use any names, everyone who has a problem sort of like theirs will think you were talking straight to them.
Joaquin was so overcome with the idea of it that he had to drink two of his bottles of water in a row to cure the sudden dryness of his mouth. This felt like the future to him. This felt like real radio.
Show me the inside of the house, Beatriz told Pete.
She did not really want to see the interior, but she had been thinking hard as Joaquin spoke and wanted to speak to Pete alone about these thoughts. As she suspected, Joaquin did not notice this strategy. He continued pacing on the beam, contemplating his grand show, as Pete joined Beatriz inside the little house. The structure was more impressive than Beatriz had expected, considering its humble origins. Now that Pete knew the little house was going to be completed instead of torn down, he took its construction more seriously. It had to earn its place among all the other buildings here if it was going to stand for any length of time. He liked the sense of Soria history and memories he had heard so far. So he had begun to build as many Soria memories and feelings into it as he could manage. He used some of the optimism from the already scavenged barn to support the floorboards, and he tinted the windows with some of the handsomeness of thought from Francisco's greenhouse, and he took some of the warm sentiment from Nana's garden for the grout between the stones. He had not meant to add his own steadfastness, nor any of his new love, but those traits had also nonetheless joined the others. This is the way of our work. We cannot help but color it with the paint of our feelings, both good and bad. Beatriz felt all of this inside the house. Her feet stood on memories, and light streamed through memories onto her, and dust drifted down from the memories in the roof supports. In a low voice, she said to him,
I have an idea, and I'm afraid if I don't say it to you, I might say it to Joaquin, and I think that would be very unwise.
She was a little surprised at herself for even telling Pete, but she knew that to give words to Pete was to give them to a vault.
Okay, said Pete.
I don't think Joaquin is wrong that the radio can help the pilgrims. I think what they have always needed is someone to guide them through, even though we are not allowed. We've seen so many pilgrims come through and we've learned how they solve their problems, but we can't share any of this knowledge with them. I don't think this was the way it always was, but I don't have any way of knowing that. Anyway, if it is true, if Joaquin's program helped Jenny last night, and if it helps the twins tonight, as I think it might, then...
Beatriz lowered her voice even further, and Pete leaned into her so that she could barely speak the words into his ear.
Then we might also be able to reach Daniel and help him heal himself.
Because while Joaquin had been discussing the radio show, he had been pacing beside the pilgrim's lodge site and thus thinking about the pilgrim's currently overflowing Bichoraro. But Beatriz had been thinking about a different pilgrim. Daniel. Pete straightened.
It's all right to be upset, he told her.
This frustrated Beatriz,
who could not understand why he would say such a thing.
I'm not upset. I am telling you the facts.
She did not realize that both of these things could be true.
All right, Pete said.
I'm not.
I said all right, Pete repeated.
He didn't want to annoy her, so he hurried on.
Here's what I think. I think you should tell Joaquin what you just told me.
And if I'm wrong, then it's false hope.
Pete wasn't much for speeches. But he'd been thinking on one sort of like this since Antonia had given him an earful before the sun had even come up. So he laid it out for her.
Well, I reckon that's what you just told me the problem was with the pilgrims, right? There's an awful lot of things that go on here that don't get said. A lot of shut doors and closed eyes just to be on the safe side. Maybe if you want things to change, you should start in yourself. Tell him what you're thinking. You might just find that it's already occurred to him, too. Everybody's thinking about Danielle, aren't they?
Beatriz was quiet for a long moment, processing his words. In that quiet, she could feel the prickle of an oncoming miracle, but she couldn't tell if it was a Soria miracle or merely the potential miracle of a life-changing radio station in a box truck.
I think, she said finally, I think you might be right.
In this way, Beatriz left the house a slightly different person than she had entered it. This was to become a hallmark of this house once it was finished, although Pete did not know it yet. She signaled for Joaquin to leave off his pacing on the beam, and when he did, she quietly shared her hopes for the radio's potential. Joaquin drank a bottle of water, and then he drank another one. He would have drank a fifth one, but he didn't have one. Eventually, he muttered, I feel like I need to write a really good show for tonight.
Pete said, I know someone who wants to give you a hand.
Chapter 23 Francisco was of two minds about Dorothy's rooster. One of those minds hated the rooster, and the other loved it. Francisco was accustomed to working on his own by now, and he was surprised to find how pleasing it was to have the rooster as a companion. Just the presence of another living creature pottering around, living its own life alongside him, was intensely grounding in a way that he had not expected. This was only when the rooster was in a good mood, however. The rooster was also of two minds, as much as a chicken can be, because of its fighting past. It had not been bred to be a fighting rooster. It had just become one as it took on its mistress's bitterness. And so the chicken was torn between its more placid self and the furious creature it had become. It would sink into the former quiet for hours at a time, pleasing Francisco. But then the light would change in the greenhouse, and the windows would become mirrors. Ragefully, the rooster would hurl itself at its own reflection with such vigor that it threatened to crack it. Blood would smear the glass, but it was only its own. Francisco had tried many things the first day, calling to the rooster, tossing pencils at the rooster, and ignoring the rooster. Francisco, after all, preferred to remain a non-participant in most wars, including this one. Eventually, however, he decided that he could not sit by and watch the rooster bloody itself on the glass. He felt it was cruel for an animal to harm itself in this way, and also, it was going to be a lot of work to clean all of the glass. So, when the light changed as the sun set and the low windows became mirrors and the rooster began to attack itself again, Francisco climbed from his chair, pulled on the long gloves that he wore to protect himself from the rose's thorns, and went to the rooster. The rooster was engaged in clawing the glass and did not think to run away. Francisco wrapped his hands around the rooster's body, pinning its wings to it, and merely held the rooster still before the glass. The rooster was forced to stare at this other impudent bird without attacking it. The bird struggled in Francisco's firm grip, and for several minutes,
Francisco worried that the bird might actually harm itself in its fervor to escape. It clawed the air and jerked its head. Its wings were miniature earthquakes beneath Francisco's palms as the rooster tried to free them. Finally, the bird stilled, panting, and gazed at itself. The rooster in the glass peered back as well, full of loathing. Francisco sighed and sat cross-legged, allowed the rooster to do nothing but look at the reflection. He remained as calm as he possibly could, so calm that the rooster would be able to feel this serenity and adopt it for itself, or at the very least to prevent anger from turning to fear. Minutes became hours, but eventually the rooster's expression changed as it realized that the image in the glass was only itself. Its body sagged, its eye turned wistful. The anger had gone from its body. Francisco released the bird, but the rooster merely slumped to the ground, still peering at itself. Dorothy would not be pleased, but Francisco was. Her rooster would never fight again. Francisco found, however, that he had become the opposite of calm. As he had been sitting there, holding the rooster still, he had been reminded of Daniel as a baby. Although it was not usual for men at that time to involve themselves in the care of an infant, Francisco had been given the lion's share of dealing with young Daniel's nightmares as Rosa, Antonia, Michael, and Nana could not soothe Daniel during them. It was impossible to say what the infant Daniel was dreaming so terribly about. Possibly the memory of being hacked from his mother's body. But one night out of every 10, he would wake in an inconsolable terror. Francisco would hold the infant, saying nothing, merely breathing, for as long as it took. 5 minutes? 5 hours. Once, while Daniel was teething, 5 days. Eventually, this stillness would transfer to Daniel, and the baby Daniel's breathing would grow long and match Francisco's. Finally, he would fall back into an unfrightened slumber. As Francisco held the rooster, he remembered all of the nights he had spent doing such a thing, and by the time the anger had drained from General MacArthur, Francisco found he could not bear the thought of Daniel in the desert any longer. He could contemplate nothing else. Leaving the rooster pensive on the floor, he fled through the night to the place that held more of Daniel than any other place in Bicho Raro, the shrine. When he entered the shrine, he found Antonia already there. His wife kneeled before the sculpture of Mary and her owls, all of the votive candles burning. She, too, had finally been overcome by the horror of Daniel's plight, and there was nothing she could do to avoid thinking of him, not even cutting paper flowers at her kitchen table. Wordlessly, he joined her, falling to his knees in the rut Daniel had worn in his years of praying as the saint. Francisco said nothing, growing ever quieter in his distress, and Antonia said nothing, growing ever angrier in her own. They were both destroyed, imagining the young man who had occupied this shrine only a few days before. Antonia, too, began to recall Daniel as a child. As a baby, Daniel had been as much a hellion as he had been in his teen years. He would chomp on Antonia's breast and feed dirt to himself, and tip over his cradle with himself in it, and eat the hair off the barn cats if they got into the house. In many ways, though, Daniel's terribleness had been a blessing. If he had been a sweet baby, Antonia's grief would have never allowed her to look at him, imagining only what it would have been like for her sister-in-law to raise him for herself. But since he was awful, Antonia would say,
"It was lucky Loyola died so that she never had to suckle a demon at her breast,"
and spend all her moments with him, and love him ferociously. Now, these memories of Daniel choked Antonia,
and she began to rage in the shrine. Ordinarily, Francisco would have said nothing, or would have removed himself, which only would have increased her anger. For years he had been saying nothing or removing himself.